Support for WPR comes from Rutabaga Paddle Sports, offering canoes, kayaks, and advice for anyone wanting to experience solitude on Wisconsin waterways. 2620 Rimrock Road in Madison or rutabagashop.com.
At about 4 o'clock, Mrs. Lynch screamed from the house. The men raced into the cabin in time to see chairs jumping to the ceiling and crashing to the floor, tinware and cooking utensils flying across the kitchen. And then, just through the open doorway, slabs of boards and scraps of iron sailing through the air. Lynch and Duffy thought that somehow they could catch the culprit if they stationed themselves at two corners of the house so that together they had a full view of all sides of the house. Mrs. Lynch stood nearby. They waited. Suddenly, a large pine box leaped into the air and landed 10 feet away on the porch. An old horseshoe that had been hanging on a peg in the milk house arced through the air and came to rest beside the box. Instantly, a commotion rocked the empty house. Duffy and the Lynches ran back inside, but everything movable had been piled high into one corner.
The account comes from the Lynch Farm in St. Croix County, Wisconsin, December 1871. A colorful folktale or a documented case of paranormal activity? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
To what extent do ghost stories reflect the times they come from? And how do these stories, and there are plenty of them, reflect our belief in ghosts and the supernatural? And what are some of the most recent reports of apparently supernatural goings-on in the vicinity of Wisconsin? Our guest is Michael Norman, the co-author with Beth Scott of Haunted Wisconsin, the third edition of which is coming out this year from the University of Wisconsin Press. He has also co-authored Haunted Heartland and Haunted America, and he's the author of Haunted Homeland and other books. He's Professor Emeritus of Journalism at the UW River Falls.
Welcome to University of the Year.
Thank you for having me.
I like the quotation you have in your book from someone who said, "I don't believe in ghosts, but I've been afraid of them all my life." Because that seems to capture this mixture of skepticism and fear that a lot of people have when you bring up the topic of ghosts and haunted houses.
I think so. Polls that I've seen, Gallup polls, indicate that about a third of all Americans believe in haunted houses and ghosts. Another 16-18% aren't sure, and 45% or so say no, they're not. But there's a significant number that believe in ghosts and haunted houses and spirits and things of that sort. And I think even for most of us, if we don't, we're a little leery about the idea of them, or we don't find it comfortable to walk through a graveyard at night or a cemetery, or we, you know, hurry by one. So I think there's a we can't really know, can we, what happens after death.
Now, when you write a book like, we'll start with Haunted Wisconsin, which takes us, I guess, back to the beginning of your series of books on this general topic. How did you get inspired to write Haunted Wisconsin in the first place, and how did you and your co-author, Beth Scott, decide on what stories to include and which not?
It's a long story, actually, because we set out to write a book, period. We didn't have a subject in mind. We thought it was, and this is in the late 1970s, when writing a book was much easier than it is today with, you know, e-publishing and so forth. But we were both journalists. She was a freelance writer. I had written articles and pieces for 30-some-odd years. I was teaching at UW River Falls. And I had, she had been a guest lecturer in some of my classes once in a while, talking about the life of a freelancer and, you know, working with editors and things of that sort. And we had some conversations about writing, and I always thought that it would, that a book is sort of the ultimate goal of most writers, to put something, you know, between covers. Now it's relatively easy to do. And she didn't think much about that. Her view was that if you're a writer, there are sprinters and milers. Sprinters write short pieces, milers write long pieces. And she was more of a sprinter. And I thought, well, it'd be fun to do something else. But we eventually settled, well, let's do a book. What do we want to write about? We were both transplants to Wisconsin. We wanted to do something nonfiction, perhaps based in the region, something that hadn't been done before. And we started reading widely. And I came upon a quote by Robert Gard, the noted folklorist and professor at UW, that in his going around the state interviewing people, he thought there were more ghosts per square mile in Wisconsin than any place else. I thought that was kind of an amazing statement to make. I pointed it out to Beth. We discovered no one had ever collected ghost stories from Wisconsin. So, hey, here was an idea. Here's something to do. And so we set off to do it, not knowing if we'd find a publisher. And we did all sorts of things. We researched, combed through libraries, archives for historical stories. We even wrote letters to newspapers around the state asking the editor to publish the letter. And we asked readers, do you have a ghost story? Is there a ghost story in the area? We'd like to hear from you. And came up with quite a few possibilities, quite a few stories. Some more solid than others, others, so to speak. So we set off. You know,
did you have a criterion as to, well, it takes two or more witnesses to make a ghost story that you'd want to print?
Right, not including the ghost.
Yeah,
Yeah, absolutely. We wanted, if possible, to have, we wanted the story to have gone on for a period of time. We weren't interested in, and there are a lot of books like that these days of, you know, the intersection of County O and Double F. Is supposed to be haunted by the figure of a woman or a woman in white. There's no substance there in more ways than one. Mm-hmm. There's nothing you can, well, who saw it? We were like reporters. You know, we want to go out, find the information, find witnesses, interview them, write the story. Almost like the traditional Halloween feature that a lot of newspapers and media do. Every Halloween there's, you know, the local ghost story or local haunted house. And so we wanted the story to have gone on for a period of time, hopefully. More than one witness, and but it was an elastic kind of criteria, you know, depending on the story. The Katy Township story is an example. That's a historical story, and there was no one living anymore who remembered those events. Although there were, we subsequently found out there were descendants of families that lived in the neighborhood who remembered their parents and grandparents talking about the Lynch case. As sort of a localized ghost story. So we weren't able to find people who witnessed the events so very long ago. That time it was 100 years. But we were able to find lots of written documentation in the newspapers and elsewhere about what went on and what occurred. So that we relied on that for the historical stories. For the contemporary stories, we interviewed people. We traveled to, you know, various places around the state.
You can make money off having a haunted house or telling a ghost story. So I would think one of the things that would be necessary to watch out for is people who are just pulling your leg and trying to make a quick buck.
Exactly. I suppose if it's a commercial enterprise, that, you know, that's always a concern. You know, with the books I've done, you know, the other side of that though is that a lot of historic inns and restaurants and places of that sort that have been around 100 years or 150 years, often you will find that, you know, the ghost story or the haunting there precedes, you know, the current owner, and it's relatively well known. I don't pay for stories. That's not been a part of what I've done. And so, you know, it's a concern. But if they're creating this out of whole cloth just to sell a few more dinners, I mean, it's a lot of effort, you know, to do that. But certainly, I mean, you have to, you know, watch for individuals who, you know, may have, you know, some mental health issues or what have you. And we came across some of those, and I have in the years that have followed.
With the Lynch affair, wasn't there a question that Mrs. Lynch might have wanted to move away from the house, so having it be haunted?
Exactly. But again, that's all conjecture now, you know, it being so long ago. But that's, I included that to show that there's a possible reason for all of this happening. I mean, you read this story and you just scratch your head and think, how in the world could all of this happen?
A lot of people seeing what's going on.
A lot of people seeing what they say they saw.
And objects flying.
Objects flying and you know, the little girl's hair being cut. Yeah, an axe, you know, thwacking, you know, into the door frame next to you. I mean, some fairly incredible things. Now, you know, did all these reporters make this up? Did they not see things? I don't know. But it's a good story, nevertheless.
With a lot of people vouching for it.
With a lot of people vouching for it over the, you know, over the years.
Yeah. Little sidebar here. Now, when I talked to you last time about 26 or 7 years ago, you had not seen a ghost, but you said that your co-author, Beth Scott, had.
Right. She had several experiences that I didn't find out about until after probably our second book was published. She, you know, because we both wanted to approach it, you know, objectively. We didn't, you know, we weren't Ghostbusters. We were never slimed, you know, never have been, you know, over the years. And we didn't want to insert ourselves into this. And, you know, I'm a parapsychologist or I'm a Ghostbuster and we're going to come in if you... We wanted to tell the stories. We, you know, the storyteller. So she has some experiences, you know, seeing her late father-in-law, who died in her home, reappearing about a year. In fact, it was on the anniversary of his death, you know, and a couple of others. And now since that time, just a few years ago, I had my own experience, my own small experience. I talk about in the preface to the new book, in which I heard in a theater someone strum a ukulele that was on a prop table when there was nobody around. And that theater is haunted by the ghost of the man who helped design this university theater. And there's one very substantiated story that a current professor had an encounter with him. And I think there may have been some connection there. So I'm not ready to call that a supernatural event, but I still haven't been able to explain exactly why I would have heard that ukulele strum when I did.
Sounds like an Aeolian harp maybe being strummed by the wind.
Something,
I don't know. There's a part of me that keeps wanting to find rational explanations for every story
Absolutely.
In your book. You
Absolutely.
Talk a little bit about, I guess, speculating as to why Wisconsin might have such a heavy number of ghost stories per square mile, including our climate and also the kinds of ethnic diversity that we have here.
Well, I'm not sure that Wisconsin, you know, if you were to go to most any state and really dig into, you know, the local culture, local communities, I think you could come up with the same number of stories. And if you really looked hard, it's just that I've been plumbing this state for so long. I think you could find the same, you know, the same numbers. With the Ridgeway ghost in southwest Wisconsin, a lot of those stories, I think, came with the Cornish miners in the early 19th century and their folk beliefs. I think that was a part of it. I think in the north, you'll find sort of the hunter ghost stories or the ghost stories that are told you know, at the deer camp and places of that sort. Milwaukee, I think with its heavily ethnic European background in past years, Eastern European immigrants, they brought many of their superstitions and folk beliefs, you know, along with them. I think where, you know, whenever you have, you know, those kind of enclaves, you'll find stories that have been brought with them from the old country.
One of the most famous does seem to be the Ridgeway ghost. Mm-hmm. What is it about that one that makes it so celebrated? And a second point would be, don't we lose a lot of these ghosts when we stop walking in the woods at night?
I mean, you know, I think you're
lifestyle
absolutely right.
Change.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're absolutely right. And I think we may lose a lot of these stories over the next, you know, decade or couple of decades, you know, as we become more oriented to electronic technology, and we don't tell stories anymore. I think, you know, any of us, if we walk around our neighborhoods, you know, at night on a beautiful summer night, there's no one sitting outside.
Right.
Nobody on a front porch.
A lot of flickering coming.
A lot
from
of
inside
flickering
the houses.
Blue light, you know, coming from inside the house. Tuned to Wisconsin Public Television, of course. I think we're going to lose a lot of that because many of these stories were passed down from generation to generation orally. And not written down, and already I'm finding that many of these stories have been lost. I think if you perhaps went to, the Mineral Point area and Ridgeway, they maybe are making a little more attempt to keep that, those legends alive. But I think a lot of those would already have been lost among the younger generation.
So anyway. So what kind of accounts do we have of the Ridgeway ghost?
Well, I think what has made the Ridgeway ghost so interesting is that there's such a variety of tales, individual instances when the ghost was supposed to have done one thing or another. It changed shape. It was a shape shifter for one thing. It would appear as a pig or a goat or an animal of some kind or horses. Other times it would appear as a human figure. It would chase people through the woods. Now, a lot of times I think perhaps those stories were created to explain why, the husband wasn't home quite on time.
Why he was drunk.
Was pink.
Exactly. I think, he probably was, I had to stop at the tavern to have another drink because the Ridgeway ghost chased me, halfway down the street. Uh-huh. I think a lot of that, took place. And it occurred over a long period of time. I mean, well into the 20th century. I mean, it started in the mid-19th and well into the 20th century, these stories were being told. Now, I haven't come across any recent ones. And again, I think that's part of an older generation. And it's nuts. The story is that it left town on the cow catcher of the last steam locomotive out of Ridgeway. Mm-hmm. And, maybe that's why we don't hear any more about it, because he's gone. I don't know where he went.
Well, people travel so much faster, too. I mean, instead of walking through 5 miles of woods at night or on horseback, you're going through at 65 miles an hour.
Exactly. And many of the historic stories, especially with women in white or the woman by the side of the road, took place in the era before cars, when you would walk down a very darkened path and cross a bridge and think you saw something, off in the corner of your eye.
And I suppose before electric lights, when you're looking at things through moonlight and kind of the shadowy...
And a swinging lantern.
Yes.
If you've ever been in the woods with a lantern,
the shadows will
look like most anything.
If you think about why we have ghost stories and belief in ghosts in so many cultures going, mm-hmm. Crossing all kinds of boundaries, why do you think that is? What does it sort of appeal to? What does it tell us about humanity that mm-hmm. we have all these ghost stories?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a very big question. I think part of it is, as I indicated earlier, we're never really sure what will happen to us once we die. Is there a great hereafter? If you're a religious person, you undoubtedly believe that there is. There is some kind of an afterlife, but we can't be sure. And I think in some ways, especially if you look at the spiritual side of spirits and ghosts, Native American traditions and others, a lot of that has to do with the afterlife, with the spirits coming back to visit the living for one reason or another. And so I think it helps us explain this veil that we're in and what is going on, and is there a possibility of afterlife? One of the more interesting statistics I saw, I referenced that Gallup poll earlier from a few years ago. There was also an indication there that belief in ghosts and spirits vary with your political beliefs, something that I had never, I wasn't aware of, that if you tend to be conservative, you have less belief in ghosts and spirits. If you're moderate or liberal, you have more belief in ghosts and spirits. Now, I don't even want to go there in terms of what that means. I guess you bring politics into everything these days. But I think that's a large part of it, that it helps us understand the afterlife, because really there is not a culture, not a society in the world that doesn't have a belief in the afterlife, and that those in the afterlife can visit the living. I think maybe part of it, too, is just a human desire to connect again with those who we've lost in our lives.
Which happens in dreams and
exactly,
as well.
Exactly.
We can have, someone we've lost come
precisely.
Back.
Precisely. And I think for those people that have some belief in ghosts and spirits, or who aren't sure, there's enough anecdotal evidence, you know, from very reliable individuals, from people who seem to, you know, have their heads screwed on correctly, that you know, Aunt Madge was actually there in that rocker, and I saw her. So there's enough of that to sort of keep ourselves wondering, well, maybe there is something.
Maybe
there.
The temporary belief in such things has a surge with every power outage, too.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think there would be more belief if we sat on porches again.
Yes.
And listened to stories.
Sat around more fires.
Yes.
Let's look at some haunted houses when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest, Michael Norman, who is the author, co-author of Haunted Wisconsin, among other books. And Haunted Wisconsin, the third edition, is out this year from the University of Wisconsin Press. Wisconsin, by any account, is fertile ground for ghost stories. But some of the stories have to come from specific places that a person presumably could even visit. Go into, get the feel of, get the sound of. Mm-hmm. Summerwind seems to be one of the most famous.
It was one of the most famous. It's burned down now, and there are only a few pieces of stone and rock and brick to show where it was. But it certainly is the one that I think captured most people's imagination for both the location deep in the Northwoods up in Vilas County on a lake. It looked like a haunted house. It looked like the quintessential haunted house.
This is the one that was written up in Life magazine?
1981, Life magazine named it one of the 9 most haunted houses in America. And actually, that's when I first became aware of it, because nothing had been written about it in the state, and we hadn't heard from anyone about this. I think at that point, some of it was promotion. The owner at that time was trying to promote it as a restaurant and lodge and so forth. And so you never really knew what was going on. We included it in a book we wrote called Haunted Heartland, and interviewed people and you know, wrote the story in there. And I decided to include it in the new edition because some years ago, a young woman from Wauwatosa contacted me and sent me a photograph that she had taken outside Summerwind before it burned. And in that photograph, it was very clear that in the corner, it was just a window above, I think, the kitchen door. In the corner of the window looked to be a face, someone looking out. And I have a large version of that photo that I take along to programs and show people and ask them if they can see the face. You know, it's also one of those stories when I tell it that people can somewhat relate to. She and her parents and her friend, she was in high school, so she brought a girlfriend along, were vacationing up there, and they heard about Summerwind. And the young woman, Mary Beth, and her friend decided to visit Summerwind. So they drove over one day, looked around. Nobody was living there at the time. It was decrepit, falling apart. And they made the decision then to come back the next night or so at midnight with a Ouija board and go into the house, which they did. And asked, you know, several questions that you do with a Ouija board, and then they asked the question, "Do you want us to leave?" And the planchette went to "in," and then to the "o," and stopped. And then very quickly she said, move to the W.
Yeah, I was wondering about that.
Well, wow. Now, when you're talking about a photograph of a face,
right,
and so on, okay, there's two things that happen in my skeptical mind. One is I think, well, maybe there was someone inside at the
absolutely
time. The second thing is maybe it's a
right
sort of camera trick,
right,
an artifact of
yeah
developing or...
Right, you know. Yeah, yeah. The first one, certainly, because, you know, I show it to individuals. Some people don't see it, but I would say that probably three-quarters of people, and it's a big enlargement I have. And this was in an era before digital photography, so it was, you know, it's an enlargement of the negative that, you know, that she had. And when I show it to individuals, including photographers, they who's looking out the window, you know, because you see the nose line and the hairline and so forth. But I make no, you know, assumptions. I mm-hmm think, you know, perhaps somebody was leaning a dress dummy up against it, or I mean something, you know, maybe that's the reason for it. I leave it up to people to decide what they.
So what happened this summer? What's the backstory, and what are the phenomena that have been observed over what period of time?
The backstory of Summer Wind is that it was built back in the 1920s by a Washington politician as his summer home, and that was in the era when they built these great rambling mansions in the North Woods on lakes, and lived there for a period of time. It changed hands. There were no documented bad things that happened, you know, in the place, at least as far as I've been able to determine. And the haunting seems to have gotten going in a way in the 1970s with certain owners, and they said that they would see ghosts, an older woman in the house. They claimed to have found pieces of skeletons in the house, other kinds of things, along that line. That the house seemed to have a particular negative effect on females in the house. You know, these kinds of things that are hard to, can't really pin
right
down in
sure
terms of, you know, they didn't see screaming banshees or things of that sort. And those individuals left, moved out in probably the mid-1980s. And, then it burned down a few years later.
So what makes it so notorious among haunted houses?
You know, I think just the location and the way it looked, and the fact that a lot of people have made up things about it that aren't, that aren't accurate, or that, today on the Internet you can find all kinds of sites about haunted places.
Yes.
And sometimes 75% of the information is wrong, or somebody has just made it up.
But it shows how much we sort of, I guess, yearn to be scared. You know, we're drawn
absolutely
to these
yeah
haunted houses.
Yeah. I mean, it does look like something out of a Hollywood movie. I mean, it really does. And I think that was part of, because you don't find those places very often, and especially those where, you can go. Neighbors got very upset because at one time tour buses were disgorging people there. After the property had been abandoned.
It really makes me wonder about what it is about us that is drawn to a haunted house. Although I suppose on a much more everyday level, anyone who's moved into a house occupied by another family will find traces. You'll find the pencil marks for measuring the height of the children, or you might find old Playboys way up high in a closet, or, just something that gives you the feeling of people who have been there that have sort of passed before you.
Mm-hmm.
So, but what do you think it is that draws so many people to haunted houses?
I think some of it is, well, maybe I'll see something. Especially if it's a haunted inn or a haunted restaurant. Well, gee, maybe if I stay in this room, the maid will, come visit, the ghostly maid, or I'll have an experience like that.
So we want to sort of have a visitation because that would be something extra. That reminds me of my mother she was comforting my brother when he thought he saw monsters at night by the bed. And she said, no, just look, it's these blankets. It's just, and he was disappointed.
Sure.
He wanted it to be something fantastical.
You want it to be real. But yet at the same time, most of us don't. It would be fun to, I think, wake up at night and see the shimmering outline of, someone in your room at the old inn. But on the other hand, we don't know how we react. I mean, it's kind of scary because we don't really know. But there are certainly enough of those people so that individuals are making a very good living doing these kinds of tours.
Well, are there really fairly convincing documented, by which I mean, again, witnessed by numbers of people, malevolent occurrences in any of these houses or places?
Yeah. That's an interesting question because I think, getting to your question, Emily, we've all grown up on Hollywood, horror movies and monster movies and The Shining and, films of that sort. So we sort of have this assumption that, these things are malevolent. They are mean. They're dangerous. They're going to come after you and they're going to cause harm to you. And once in a while you read about those kinds of stories. But when I do, I'm always skeptical because, in 30 years, I've never met anyone physically harmed by a ghost or by a spirit. I mean, it just, the people who say they've had these experiences, it's very clear that whatever they experienced exists in some kind of a different plane, some kind of a different, different level. They don't care what you're doing. They're not going to come after you, And I think that's part of it. But I've not. There was one case, and it got quite a bit of publicity at the time, and it's in Haunted America. There was a case from Horicon.
Yes, I've heard of a Horicon case.
We interviewed the couple that lived in this house with their children.
It was a bunk bed, wasn't it? A haunted bunk bed.
It was a haunted bunk bed. It was eyes peering in windows. It was objects moving all through the house. Beth and I spent a day with the couple and interviewing them. Later on, Unsolved Mysteries did an episode about it and used the actual house. It's a pre-made home. It was a Wausau home at one time, they used to call them. Completely ordinary. I mean, nothing unusual about it at all. But the family was so terrified, they moved out of the house. I mean, in the middle of a winter night, they just packed up the children, and it occurred when the husband saw this figure, literally rising out of the floor. I mean, it was the Exorcist kind of thing. And they moved out. The police chief, Chief Glauman over there, investigated the family, looked into the case, found nothing to indicate that they were creating this or trying to, they didn't have any issues, anything of that sort.
No way to benefit from it.
No way to benefit. In fact, they were financing the house through FMHA at the time, and FMHA took it over and agreed to reimburse the family for their loss. So I mean they were absolutely traumatized. So that's really the only.
And so how was the whole thing resolved, though? The house still exists? The bunk bed
still
exists?
As far as I know, well, the bunk bed they got rid of. But
We hope not on eBay.
Not on eBay. No, Craigslist, maybe. So it's still in the area. They moved out, and I haven't followed the house. I assume it's still there. Family moved into it, and this has been a number of years ago. There was nothing.
That's what seems to happen.
It was strange. It's very weird because, the family. When we interviewed them, it was a year after the event. I mean, they were still traumatized by it. I mean, they were still. I mean, the husband could hardly talk about the issues, and I don't know what caused it. There was an old graveyard not far away. I don't know.
But they didn't have any problems after they left the house, and the people who moved into the house didn't have any problems.
No, as far as I know, they moved to another town not far away, and the last I knew, they were they were fine. They turned down at the time. Oprah Winfrey wanted them on the show, and they were getting all kinds of offers, and absolutely wanted nothing to do. They just wanted their lives back. So what was it? I don't know. It was very strange, though.
I wonder if some of the haunted house interest comes from the idea of guilt and secrecy. The expression, if walls could talk, all the secrets.
Maybe they do.
Just this notion that maybe a murder took place or domestic abuse or mistreatment of a child. And I wonder if some of this sense of specters and phantoms within a house are maybe our sense that there are these secrets that we'd like to think would somehow, mm-hmm. You know, that there'd be justice at some point.
Absolutely. And that's why whenever I interview people, whenever I go to one of these places, that's one of my first questions. You know, have you looked into the history of the house or the inn or the, you know, the restaurant? I mean, was there something that happened here that you can document? Now, in many older places, you can't. I mean, if the inn is 150 years old, there's just, you know, no way you could do that. You have to assume, though, at least I do, that if it's an old hotel or old inn, more than likely bad things happen there. You know, the worst murder and at the least, you know, some kind of physical abuse or physical confrontations. I like to think where there was a lot of life, there was the possibility of a lot of afterlife as well, you know, that you know, the specters can linger. And I agree. I think a lot of it is wondering, you know, if someone was killed, you know, will there be justice or would there be justice in, you know, in some way?
Or are they buried in a crawl space?
Or are they buried in the crawl space? I mean, which you find in from the 19th century anyway, people were often buried on the farm or, you know, just, you know, wherever. There weren't the kinds of regulations that there are, or buried in the basement or their bodies stuffed into a crawl space. That was one of the stories, in fact, with Summerwind, that they supposedly found a skeleton stuck into a crawl space, although later there was apparently no evidence of that. But those kinds of things are kind of chilling to think that, gee, maybe in the basement of my old house, there's somebody's buried down there. I mean, it's kind of an ish, you know, sort of thing.
What's the story about the Hilly house?
The Hilly curse, I called it in Waukesha. That was that's a story that is really more of a curse than it is a haunting. Although John Hilly, the original owner, it was his ghost that Dorothy Ransom, the owner at the time we interviewed her a number of years ago, saw walking up the driveway of the house.
Right.
They were German immigrants. It was an interesting story in that some of it involved anti-German sentiment during the years just prior to World War I and then during World War I as well. They were still very Germanic in their traditions and their speech and so forth. And you'll find that in some stories, that there was almost created sometimes a ghost story, sometimes other kinds of stories to sort of explain or to say, well, why these strangers, why these people we don't know, why they're doing, you know, these bad things. And it was the same way with the Hilly family, that they were in the years prior to World War I, the target of anti-German sentiment. There were some suicides involved in that. And other things. It was again, the house looked like a haunted house. I mean, stone and
how did the curse actually
people
take
dying
place?
Associated with the house, and whether or not you believe it's an extraordinary number or not, you know, depends on your perspective. And not just dying, but dying either unexpectedly or dying young, and tragedies, drowning or getting caught in a hay baler or, you know, things of that sort. There was at least a couple of documented suicides of some of the early Hilly family members, and then the ghost of John Hilly, you know, being seen at the farm. Some years later, I met the people who lived at the farm after Dorothy Ransom, and said that it was very quiet and nothing odd was going on. So
again, that pattern.
Right.
We're going to look more at Haunted Wisconsin when we continue in a moment on University of the Year. eerie accounts and unsolved mysteries from Door County to Dodgeville, from Milwaukee to Madeline Island. Grab a cozy blanket, light a few flickering candles, and enjoy the unnerving tales of haunted Wisconsin, gathered from personal interviews with credible eyewitnesses, on-site explorations, historical archives, newspaper reports, and other sources. These scores of reports date from Wisconsin's early settlement days to recent inexplicable events. Are ghosts real? That's for you to decide. That's from the blurb for Haunted Wisconsin, the third edition, by Michael Norman, our guest this hour on University of the Air. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Well, if we look at all these sort of supposedly inexplicable events that you've included, you do here and there in the book come up with some scientific explanations that certain flickering lights on the marsh might be from the gases that can arise. And one notable example where you do come up with an explanation is the one about the Paulding Light.
Right, just across the border, Wisconsin border, into the UP. So it's not technically haunted Wisconsin, but it's, you know, in that in that general vicinity. And, yeah, that's an interesting one because I mean, even the government's gotten involved because there are signs erected by the Forest Service and by the tourism people, you know, explaining the Paulding Light and here it is and there you can park and, you know, and so forth. It's a mystery light, and there are a lot of mystery lights around the country. And there's the Hornet Spook Light in Missouri. There's a ghost light in North Carolina, Texas, you know, all over. And this is sort of our local, you know, our regional, you know, ghost light. And, you know, the situation is the same as with others. If you are, if you park at a certain place and you look down in a certain direction, you will see, you know, a white light coming at you and seeming to dance around. And sometimes you'll see red and green lights, you know, along with it. And, you know, it's a haunted train or it's, you know, some kind of a ghostly manifestation. And it's been very popular over the years. And this was a case in which a geography professor at the University of Wisconsin River Falls, Don Pitzold, and two of his students solved, you know, the light. His two students were from that area, and it's a great high school tradition, you know, that you take your date, you know, up and you see the Paulding Spook Light, and you park and, you know, and see the light, and everybody in the area has done it, and it's just this great thing. And Don Pitzold, as a geographer, had never heard of ghost lights or spook lights or things like that. So he found it fascinating. And he and the two students decided to research it, taking, you know, cartography maps and, you know, all kinds of things of that sort. And were able to show that it's actually, you know, in the woods up there, you know, you lose sense of direction. You know, and this was before the era of, you know, GPS and, you know, they were going by maps, trying to figure out where they were. And you think you're turning one direction and you're actually turning another, especially at night when you don't, unless you know the stars and constellations, you don't really know what direction you're going. And he was able to show that it actually is a U.S. highway, U.S. Highway 45, that people are seeing some, you know, 5 to 7 miles in the distance on a downgrade. You know, so all you're seeing are the lights and sometimes they blink and hop, you know, and pass around. And the people who park and looking and are looking at the lights don't think they're looking in another direction than actually at the highway. But he was able to show that that really is what it is. And yet people still go, they still believe, because they don't want to believe that it's not ghost lights, that it's not spook lights.
Headlights are not exciting.
Headlights are not exciting, no. You know, that was a case in which there was a clear explanation for what it was. So I wanted to solve it for people.
You've got a ghost island in haunted Wisconsin.
That's really one of my favorite stories, because the man who's the center of it, Al Denninger, this is in the Chippewa Flowage area up near Hayward, Wisconsin. He was a fishing guide, one day in late October, he and a client, another man, were out fishing for muskies when they saw a bulbous form that seemed to be moving against the wind and moving down the shore of an island across from which they had put their lines into the water. And Al, with a Polaroid camera, took a picture of it. And again, it's a photo that I use in my programs. Really one of the oddest photos of an object I've seen, and especially when you combine that with his account of how it took place. The other interesting thing about Al is that, you know, he's a fishing guide. And so, you know, fishermen, you know, we just, how big was that fish? You know, we're always a little doubtful about
tall
whether
tales.
Or not. Tall tales, right. So I was always a little doubtful. But Al, until his retirement several years ago, was a Milwaukee firefighter, professional firefighter, and is now retired, living in Rhinelander. Reminded me a little bit of the actor Roy Scheider from he played the sheriff in Jaws, if you remember that, you know, that actor. Tough, no-nonsense sort of guy. Knew what he knew, saw what he saw, didn't care whether I believed it, didn't care whether, you know, other people believed it. It was a rather lengthy amount of time before or after this happened to him, and the story sort of got out. Because he showed the picture to some resort owners there and subsequently discovered that the island on which, you know, he saw this object along the shoreline has been called Ghost Island for many years by the owners of a resort whose resort looks out on this island. And it's because their customers staying in cabins closest to that island, sort of at the end of two arms around a lagoon, at night would see lights, would hear voices, would hear kind of odd things going on. And all of the islands in the Chippewa flowage, you know, are public, but you can't camp on them. There's no overnight camping. You can do a shore lunch, or you could, I think they may hunt there in the fall, but you know, there would be no reason for anyone to be there at night. And it was, you know, such an interesting situation that the owners of that resort started keeping a log of, you know, people's comments, you know, about what they saw on that island. And it turns out that's the island that the photo was taken on. And Al found that out. And so it's you know, again, it's not an ongoing story. But it's a story in which what occurred, him watching this object move down the shoreline and then eventually up into the air, there just seems to be no real easy explanation for what that was. There were no clouds. They were the only ones there. It wasn't a puff of you know, smoke from a gasoline engine. The object stayed the same shape. So unless you dismiss him completely as a witness, and the photo that he took, and again, it was a Polaroid at the time, so there's no negative, there's no manipulation of it. You think, well, what was it that he saw? He said, and he'd been at that time working as a guide there for about 20 years, and he said, I have never, ever seen anything like that before in my life.
What shape did it take?
I would call it bulbous. It had a distinct sort of human shape almost to it. It looked like, and I hate to say this, but it looked like a miniature Stay Puft Marshmallow Man.
Back to Ghostbusters there,
exactly.
Michael.
I mean, it's rather odd, but it looks a little bit like that, except a little more amorphous. You can almost see it tapers to the bottom. It tapers at the bottom, and it comes up into almost the shape of someone's upper torso. You almost see two little, you know, what could be arms and a little kind of a bulge at the top. I mean, it's very strange. You know, I made an enlargement of it. And, you know, when I show that in programs, you know, people just scratch their heads.
Transparent?
So, no, solid.
Solid,
a solid object. And what amazed him more than anything else is that, you know, as an outdoorsman, he's very attuned to the weather and very attuned to what's going on. This object seemed to be moving. The wind was blowing toward the island, and this object seemed to be moving against the wind. That's what puzzled him so much. And it was a very overcast, very cloudy, and the object seemed to move down the shore, pause, and then just rose, you know, up into the air.
And I'm thinking fog vapor, but no.
Not if it doesn't change shape.
It didn't change shape.
And wind.
You know? And again, I mean, he's been a guide on that on the flowage for 20 years. You know, and in winter, fall, spring, said I've never seen it. And to me, that was a case in which the witness made the story even more interesting to me. Because, you know, a man who's been a firefighter in Milwaukee knows smoke, he knows heat, he knows what the wind does. He understands that. And there'd be no reason for him to do this, you know, to make up this story and to, mm-hmm. you know, create a photograph. And when they saw it, they were both just, I mean, dumbfounded.
You know, the resort owners.
No, Al Denninger and his client when they saw the saw the object.
And it helps to have someone with you that can corroborate it, I'm
absolutely.
Sure.
Absolutely.
One of the things that struck mm-hmm. me in your book is, although there were some mean ghosts mm-hmm. and evil spirits, mm-hmm. you also told a lot of accounts of people who encountered a sort of kindly presence,
sure.
a grandmother figure mm-hmm. or mm-hmm. someone they felt was mm-hmm. watching over them.
Right,
as
right.
if it satisfied a need we have not to feel alone.
Absolutely. And I think that's a large part of our interest in ghost stories as well. You know, wouldn't it be nice if my late mother, you have a new child or a new baby, wouldn't it be nice if grandma, you know, was here to see the baby, you know, and then something happens and you think grandma actually does come and, you know, and visit. And there have been a number of those, you know, instances in which there was one in particular, and I was never able to convince the man to sit down for an interview with him, but he was a police sergeant at a Minnesota city who told me this extraordinary story of his grandmother, seeing his grandmother in her rocker on the second floor of his house in the room that she lived in during her last years of life. And again, it was a situation where, you know, he told me the story because he knew I'd written some of these books, but he didn't want to go on the record. And he didn't want to sort of have that, you know, people saying, oh, you're seeing ghosts, right? But he said it absolutely happened. She was there. She smiled at me, nodded her head. And it was a case in which they had just had a baby. And he said, I didn't create this vision. He said, I've been a police officer for 20 years. You know, she was there. You know, and then, you know, then she left. So, you know, you hear those stories, anything. You know, there's enough anecdotal evidence like that that people who are even skeptical say, okay, well, yeah, maybe he didn't make it up. But, you know, you see what I mean? That, you know, there's enough of that, those anecdotes that we think, well, maybe there's something there.
So is there a great story that's not in the book?
Is there a great story? Probably the next one that I find. Or there are some other Wisconsin stories, like the Horicon story that I didn't have room for in this one, but that's in, you know, in other books that, you know, that I've done. I think, you know, there are a couple of that I've heard about that are bed and breakfasts or inns, where despite, you know, you were thinking, well, they use it for a promotion, you know.
Sure.
There are some places that don't want the information out.
Keep people away.
More likely to
keep people away.
They won't want it for their honeymoon suite.
Exactly. In fact, referring back to that survey I was talking about, you know, they have found that people tend to split into one of two camps. Either they really want to stay in the haunted room in the inn, or they want to stay as far away from the room as they can possibly get. And I think a lot of these, you know, a lot of business owners, you don't want to do things to turn off your potential customer base, and a lot of them say no. You know, so I've heard stories about some bed and breakfasts that, you know, I haven't been able to get anybody to sit down. And so, if any other edition of this is done, you know, then maybe then, but probably not.
If you have a story, maybe it'll be in the next edition of Haunted Wisconsin. Our guest has been Michael Norman. He's the co-author of Haunted Wisconsin, which is coming out in its third edition this year from the UW Press. And thanks for guiding us through some of those shadowy stories of Haunted Wisconsin.
Thank you, Norman. Thank you, Emily.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach. I hope you can join us for the next hour of University of the Air.